And Eve Arnold, I want to welcome you back to Fresh Air. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Why did you want to do a study of America? You actually don't live here anymore. You're truly based in England, but this is the place where you grew up.
This is the place where I grew up, and this is the place where my heart is, and I wanted to come back and see what it was like. I came back 3 years ago to finish a book that I had photographed in China. And when I came here, it was so wonderful, and I had come from a country in which it was a totally almost primitive and agricultural country who wanted to reach the kind of computer world that we have reached. And I wondered whether that was a good idea, and I wanted to see what had happened in the 20 years that I'd been away. And I thought if I had anything to offer, it was that absence. And with any kind of luck, an eye which had seen other cultures and other places.
One comparison I can think of between China, the subject of your previous photographic book, in America, is that they're so hard to generalize about, and they're so big. There's so many different cultures within the countries.
Well, this is what we have here, an entirely diverse country. You walk from one street to another, and you find such enormous differences. You find it difficult to believe that there are so many a difference in color and a difference in creed and a difference in financial background. And everything is different from the other thing. And it's not just the one region will differ from the other. It's that within the region there, each street is a polyglot. And it's kind of marvelous.
How did you decide where you were going to travel and what you were going to look for to put between the covers of your book?
I wanted this to be an open adventure. I wanted to be able to find out what was going on, not to decide beforehand, because if I did, then I would have already made my judgment. I wanted to know what was going on, and there were a lot of questions that came to mind. I wanted to know what had happened to women in the 20 years that I'd been away, what had happened to the blacks, what about civil rights. What about the economy? Everything seemed to want to be answered for me. And so I started traveling to try and find out, and I started with the American Indian. I figured that it was my private joke. I thought the American Indian had been here first, and maybe if I started with them first, that I would learn something I didn't know. And so I went out to the far west, and with a totally open mind, I didn't know anybody out there, and within days, Miss Navajo 1976 was my guide and taking me through the Navajo reservation where I spent 3 weeks. And that was kind of marvelous. There was everything from peyote ceremony on through women baking bread in adobe ovens the way they had since time began.
What were the mental pictures that you took with you through America? Because I think when you travel to another country, you have a kind of mental scrapbook of the images that you think of when you think of home.
I suppose I tried to block out any preconceived notions, although, sure, I couldn't help but carry with me, the great visual places like the Rocky Mountains and the mighty Mississippi. And although I saw them and photographed them, I decided in the end not to use them. So much has been done that I felt that there was not much I could add. What I felt that I might be able to try to understand was what people were like here. And it seems to me that a country is made up of its people, and these were the answers for me.
You went into strip joints and traveled with the Hell's Angels, went to the church that Jerry Falwell preaches in. Were these places that you wouldn't have felt comfortable going had it not been for the photograph, for the camera strapped over your shoulder?
No. This was a combination of a personal investigation and a professional job. And I practically never do anything that doesn't interest me, that I wouldn't do if I didn't have the camera. Because there were many times when I photographed and talked to people and interviewed, we didn't use it in the book. There were things that made it easier for me to understand the next step, because it was like a chain reaction. Wherever I went, somebody would say, "Have you seen?" and "Do you know?" And then before I knew it, I would be up in Maine looking at the last existing Shaker settlement, or I would be down in the South talking to a man who ran an African village, which he calls his kingdom. And he sits on a throne with all his gold robes and has 20 children and 7 wives. and this outside Beaufort, South Carolina. So there were all kinds of things that interested me. In addition, you know, to the economy and the daily problems, there were all these outside kind of wonderful forms of self-expression.
When you went down to Lynchburg, Virginia, which is where Jerry Falwell has his congregation, and you took several pictures of Falwell and of the congregation and the choir there, I think, did you want to pass judgment on them in any way? Because I think when Falwell and his followers are photographed, it's either with a vision of piety or one of derision. You know, did you want a point of view in the way you shot them like that?
I don't think that any of us is that pure, that we don't have ideas of what we believe in. There isn't wind whistling between your ears. You have an idea of what there is. I didn't want to be judgmental with this. I wanted to find out what caused people to follow this man. What was fascinating to me, I had met Falwell in Washington first, and he suggested I come down to Lynchburg, Virginia, which I did about a month after I'd photographed him. The photograph of him in the book was taken in his office in Washington, which is a beautifully appointed office with a view of the Capitol. You know, just stunning, very expensive place. And he said at the time, why don't you come down to Lynchburg? So when I went down, I'd forgotten his telephone number, left it back in New York, and the address and so on. But I knew that he was at the Thomas Road Church. So I looked it up in the Yellow Pages, and to my surprise, there were so many churches listed, I couldn't believe it. So I counted them. Lynchburg is a town of 75,000 people. How many churches do you think were just listed in the phone book, never mind the ones that weren't listed?
How many?
122, which I think is a lot of churches. So I wanted to find out, this was the Bible Belt. This is the part of the world where people worship and they believe in what they do. And this is not new in the United States. The electronic church is new, but the numbers of churches and the varied beliefs are not new. And this, too, is America. And I wanted to know what was happening. I tried in the book simply to record what I saw, to show it through my eyes, which to some people may be sitting in judgment. But simply to show it the way I saw it and to let other people judge as to what they believed when they read it. And they can see what they want to see.
You also went to a club with a male stripper and photographed him with his G-string on, or whatever you'd call it for a male. What was your experience like in the club?
I was amazed at how many young women there were. There were 300 women there the night. This was at Sneaky Pete's in Union, New Jersey. And women came, and the check, I think, by the time they got through drinking and eating, the average check was about $20 or $25. And there were two wedding parties, two girls who were being married the following day. It was like a male stag party. And as the male dancers, strippers, went through the club dancing and going near the women and doing their numbers, the women would fold dollar bills the long way and put them into the G-string, having been told that they mustn't touch the front of the man, you know, the pot which he keeps his jewels. That was sacrosanct. And one woman did, and she was sort of frog marched out. And then two brides each gave the man $20. So at the end of the evening, he had netted, in addition to his fee, something like $600 in tips.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and the women enjoyed it thoroughly.
Did he pose for you?
What he did, he kept dancing. When he got tired, he kind of drooped down onto the floor, still holding his kind of very male and almost a kind of narcissist pose. And then I photographed him, but I photographed him in many positions in many ways. There were not only he, there were six others. And then at the end of the evening, there was a very funny thing. There wasn't room for it in the book, where there were six of the dancers lined up with just their bottoms, you know, just their backsides and the G-strings on. And the women applauded, and the one with the most attractive buns got a bottle of champagne.
What do you think of this as a phenomenon? That's part of what you were trying to come to terms with.
Well, we've had these kind of phenomena again and again. We've had taxi dancers and flagpole sitters, and we have it, you know, periodically. And it seems to me at times of stress, you get almost more of this. We had it during the Depression, particularly the taxi dancers. I don't know. There were female mud wrestlers. There are all kinds of kookiness. And this is part of the kind of individuality of this country, and I think it's wonderful.
Let's get to the Guardian Angels. Now, you spent some time traveling around the trains with them, and I think most of our listeners are familiar with them. They're an independent group who were patrolling the trains in New York and for a while in Philadelphia, though I don't know what's become of them here. Was it easy to get hooked up with them and to get their permission to?
It was not easy, but I did it in the end, and I liked them. I was prepared to be worried about the fact that I thought that maybe they might become a very strong paramilitary group, and under the leadership of somebody who was not very nice, could do damage. But the kids I spoke to were kind of marvelous. There was one 16-year-old boy whom I photographed, and I said, "Why did you join?" And he said, "I live in the East Bronx, and every morning I would get on the subway to go downtown to the technical school where I'm learning how to be a draftsman." And he said, "Sitting on the train when I got on would be middle-aged white women, and they'd be clutching their purses to themselves." And he was a very beautiful young man with a gold earring in his ear. And he said, "I could see them thinking, and that, what is this black with a single earring going to do to me?" And they would clutch their purses more tightly to themselves. And he said, "I could see hate in their faces, and I didn't want their hate for myself or for my people. So I joined the Guardian Angels in the hope that I could be of some help. And I rode around with them for a week, and never did I see anything except courtesy and concern for the people who were on the subways. They bought their own uniforms. They pay their own way.
Were you with
them?
And
do it on their own time.
Were you with them when they caught any people in the act of crime?
No. No, nothing happened. It was whether it's because, you know, they saw this gray-haired lady along with them, that nothing happened. I'd be sitting off in a corner. It was a very quiet period during the time that I rode with them. Nothing. Although one night when I didn't ride with them, the next day one of them came in with a black eye. He'd been poked in the nose by somebody.
Well, the New York subways are quite an experience between the people throwing up and the people trying to steal your purse. Did you experience the subways differently as a kind of surrogate guardian angel than you do when you're a passenger?
I'm afraid that I don't ride the subways very much.
Say, you don't know
my
what you're
one missing. Extravagance is taxicabs, so I haven't had much experience with it. It hasn't been time. I've been around the country so much.
When you're photographing America, are there any images that you want to avoid? In other words, images that you think have been photographed a lot or have been kind of hallmarked, you know, that have become corny through their greeting card type use.
I don't know. I always feel that everything is grist for the photographer. I don't like to rule anything out. As I said, I didn't do the many things that have been done. Simply because I felt that it didn't add anything, didn't illuminate anything. But normally, even the most hackneyed thing. When I started out, I did a birth, and not many people had done births, but since then, many people have done births. And I myself have probably photographed more births than most doctors have delivered babies. But in spite of that, I always find that if you have something fresh to say and something you have a need to say, then there's everything should be available to you. I've photographed circuses, and many people have done circuses. And I still would go back because it interests me.
It's depressing, isn't it, when you have to think of a birth as being a kind of cliched image?
It's not quite cliched, yes, but it's something that has been done many times now. As one of the early photographers, I was one of the early ones who did it. But there's still many, many ways to photograph it. You know, we've had painters who photographed ballet and photographed circus and probably the one salient image that I can think of is the many times that painters have painted bullfights, and everybody from Goya forward and backward and Picasso, and all their images are different. So why should the photographer rule out anything?
Eve Arnold is my guest, and we're discussing her latest book of photographs, which is called In America, and it's just been published by Knopf. Now, you also have some photographs of the Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and other Klan members. Was it hard to get access to the Klan?
Not really. They really, the thing that is interesting, and it may be the influence of television in this country, there was practically no time at which people were saying no to me. First of all, one of the most wonderful things that I found that I didn't expect was just how articulate Americans are. I had never thought of us as being verbally that good. And people wanted to talk. I was overrun with words. I was overrun with pictures. It was really quite wonderful. The Klan, no, was not that difficult to get to. The wizard spoke at length to me two separate nights, insisted upon burning a cross on a Thursday where normally they would have burned it on a Saturday simply because I was there with a camera. What surprised me about that was just how young some of the members were. Still young, pimply-faced, 20-year-old kids with their guns and their belief in what they were doing.
How did it make you feel to know that your presence was the motivation behind an extra cross burning that week?
Scared the hell out of me. It wasn't an extra one. They didn't do it on
Saturday.
They just moved it up.
Okay.
It worried me. It did worry me. Again, I wanted to raise questions, and I hope the book raises more questions and gives answers. I have no answers. I don't know whether any of us does, but I think there's such a richness here and so much we take for granted, and I just wanted to investigate and find out.
Did you? Did the people in the Klan have any idea of where you stood on the issues?
No, I just listened. I don't know. I would guess they were very careful to use the word black instead of the other word they would have used 20 years ago. That surprised me. They were very anti-women. They figured the women were okay in the kitchen and in the bed. They talked about that. No, they stood for a lot that I don't stand for and that I would find horrible. But I still felt that too is part of America and that too should be shown.
When we spoke last on Fresh Air, we were talking about China, and you had to summarize a lot about that very large country. What would you tell someone from another country about America, having completed this book and trying to collect different images from it?
Well, the thing that I found about this country, I loved the friendliness and the graciousness, and there were some wonderful, wonderful people here. I think I would say that this is the most varied, probably the most exotic country I've ever been in my life. And as you know, I've worked all over the world. It's, you know, I think of this country, I think the variety is simply staggering.
Can you tell us how you first started photographing?
I was going to be a doctor. And while I was at school, somebody gave me a camera. And a beau of mine gave me a camera. And that was it. I simply took off with it. I loved it. I loved the idea of being able to have an idea in my mind and then take that idea and go with it and hold the black box in my hand and then come back with something I could look at. It's really a very exciting thing that I think. I think I'm one of the lucky people. I've been singularly fortunate in doing what I enjoy doing, in learning about the world, and, you know, when I have an idea of something I want to do. Usually there's an editor who is going to say, you know, do you want to go to China? Fine, will you do a book? I'm going to India. I've been there a couple of times. I'm going back in March to do a story. And Sunday Times in London, from where I've worked for many years, is sending me. And it's just wonderful to be able to dream up your own ideas and then have somebody have enough faith in you to back you with it.
Had you ever considered becoming a studio photographer?
I've done studio work. I've made films and I've done all sorts of photography. I've done advertising. I've done all sorts of things. But my real love is documentary photography and working with people.
Was it hard to get assignments when you started with magazines? And did being a woman stand in your way at all?
Oh, being a woman is one of the best things in the world for a photographer. I know that there are women who would argue this. But I know from 30 years of experience, men like to be photographed by women. Women don't feel that they have to play a sexual game. It's really one of the best things. You know, it's more important almost than the camera. Being a woman has been such a wonderful thing. In China, it was just terrific because as an old woman, I was accepted without question. I was in the right place at the right time. You know, it was just marvelous. And here again, there were no questions. It was just absolutely terrific. men, women, children, whatever I wanted, you know, just simply came my way, simply because people didn't feel threatened because they felt that I was not going to savage them in any way.
Do you think most women photographers feel that way?
I don't know most women photographers. I've talked to some. Mary Ellen Mark is a lovely photographer. I think has found an advantage. You don't use your feminism as such. You don't pile it on. You don't worry about it. But the fact that you exist as a woman somehow or other softens everything around you.
You have worked for Magnum photographic agency. How does that work? What kind of relationship do you have with the agency when you're in a country, foreign country?
Magnum is a cooperative. It's owned by us, the photographers. There are about 25 of us. It was started some 30 years ago by four photographers. Robert Coppa, who was a great war photographer. Henri Cartier-Bresson, who was one of the world's greats. David Seymour and George Roger. And after the war, what they did, they divided up the world among the four of them. Each one took a section of the world that they wanted to work in. They formed this agency with the idea, and it's since been beneficial to many photographers, that we the photographers, would own copyright to our work. So that, although I've done most of my new books in China and in America are books that have been begun from the very beginning as books, intended as that. My earlier books were compilations, but because I own the rights to my own work, I could do those books. My work now goes on being shown in encyclopedias, on film, or wherever people need a situation that I have happened to photograph. And so this has permitted us, Magnum, the photographers in Magnum, to set up an office in Paris and one in New York. We have about 100 people working for us, for the 25 of us. We have 14 agents around the world, so that the pictures that are done, let's say I'm going to do this India story for the Sunday Times in London, that story will be syndicated around the world by Magnum and will in all probability maybe appear in a dozen or 20 or 50 different magazines. The China material has appeared in many, many places. So that's the way it works. They act as agent and archive. And the archive is very important because we have an archive going back to the late 30s with people like Cartier-Bresson. And so the material is available for use and is seen constantly. And that's the way the agency works.
Do you do any of your own archiving work?
Well, each of us does our own preparation before the material goes into the library at Magnum. We write our own captions and do our own text blocks and prepare it. And sometimes you do it alone, sometimes you do it with an assistant.
Do you like to photograph your own work or do you send it out? I mean, develop.
Process it. Well, I've been working in color for the last two books. And the last number of stories that I've done have been in color. It seemed that when I work in black and white, occasionally I will go into the dark room, but I found that I have no time for dark room work and writing, and a long time ago I opted to be able to write. With color, it's very difficult to do your own processing. Up until the last few years, it hasn't been possible. If you work in Kodachrome, it had to go through Kodak. Now it's possible to do your own. But I still don't do it because I just haven't the time or the energy for it. However, I'm printing the show that will appear at the Castelli Gallery at the moment with just approving it, going into the dark room with the people who are doing the work and saying, yeah, I want it like this or I want it like this. And the way of controlling it is to be there with the printer so that I was in Chicago for the printing of the In America book, working for 3 weeks with the printers night and day when it was on the presses.
You photograph for many different magazines. Do you know at this point what their styles are? Would you see things differently depending on who you were on assignment with?
I try to consider the needs of each magazine. But when I work primarily the way I see it. Going beyond, you know, if I see something that I particularly don't know whether the magazine would run it or not, I will photograph it and then present it to them. But in the meantime, keeping in mind the way they present their material so that a single story of mine, one example that has worked for me, is a long time ago in the early 50s, I photographed Marlene Dietrich. And I must have about 40 different magazine layouts of the way the material was used differently because, you know, they think differently, they present differently. But I think that if you have something to say and you say it as honestly and as decently as you know how, there's always enough material that it almost lays itself out. But I think unconsciously I think of picture stories. I don't think of the single image. And working even with a book within America, I was thinking of America itself as a single essay and trying to give a sense of what was going on within the 48 states.
Do you ever take your camera when you're not on assignment or not working on a book?
Never. I get a lot of flack from my colleagues who feel that one should carry a camera at all times. And all of them usually have a camera around their neck or around the wrist, or there's always a camera in a pocket or something. I like to keep my eyes fresh. I feel that I'm missing so much. I feel almost blinded sometimes when you put the camera up against the eye. And I think that unconsciously that led me to writing so that I wouldn't have to always be looking at the world through this black box.
When you're walking up to someone and taking their picture, do you tell them who you are and what you're taking it for, if they've noticed you?
Sometimes. Sometimes you simply photograph, and sometimes you talk to people and tell them what you're doing. Each situation will change. When I was working on the In America book, I carried the China book around with me as kind of a calling card because then people would know I was serious. I was not just off the streets, and I was trying. I had something to say and needed help and acceptance. And so I would show the book, and very often I would simply wind up in somebody's home and they would ask me to spend the night or offer me a meal or whatever. It was really quite wonderful, the hospitality I received here.
But if someone notices that you're photographing them, is it okay to just walk away, take the photograph and walk away? Or?
No, I usually walk up and tell them what I'm doing and ask them if I can use it.
And take down their name and everything?
Yeah.
You're sending people copies of this book? I know you did for some of the people
yes.
in China.
Yes, yes. I've been sending out books like crazy in the last week.
So now you're traveling around America on an interview tour. Is the America that you're seeing now similar to the one that you were seeing with your camera?
Oh, I'm seeing the inside of a limousine and the inside of a radio and a television studio and a hotel and then on with it. I've seen so much that I feel it'll last me for a little bit. And I just loved it.
So you're off to India next?
Mm-hmm. I'm going back to England, play with my 6-year-old grandson for a bit, and then off to India.
And what will you be looking for in India?
I've got a bad throat. What I'm doing in India is a rather marvelous story on the Maharani of Gwalior. It's a state, it's a princely state in northern India. She was head of the Janata Party, which was the opposite party to Indira Gandhi's party. And she was jailed by Indira Gandhi. Her son is now in Indira Gandhi's cabinet. And so the family is often opposite political sides of the Indian spectrum. She has a daughter who lives in New Orleans, whom I heard about on this trip that I took around the United States and met a young writer who was a friend of the daughter of the Maharani. And the thing that's marvelous is the palace of the family is a copy of Versailles. And there's some funny things about it. They have the largest crystal chandelier that's ever been made. It's Venetian glass. And when they went to hang it at the end of the last century, they weren't sure the ceiling could hold it. So they hung 3 elephants on the ceiling to see if it would hold. They're Jains, and their beliefs lead to ancestor worship. And in the family cemetery, there are these life-size figures, and they're dressed every day by the servants and fed by the servants, and at day's end, the food and the clothing is given to the poor, and it's this that I will be photographing, and I think it's a fascinating story.
Well, good luck with the story and with your trip to India, and thank you so much for talking with us about In America. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. It was good to be here.
Eve Arnold has been my guest, and her new book of photographs is called In America. It's just been published by Knopf, and there's also a show of her American photographs that will open in New York at the Castelli Gallery on December 3rd, and it will run there through January 7th. That's at the Castelli Gallery in New York. Her book, again, is called In America, and it's published by Knopf.